From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, October the 17th, 2019. We have a good show lined up for you this morning. Later on, we're going to be doing one of our Seeds to Society segments with the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, talking about labor issues on Vermont's dairy farms. That should be an interesting conversation. And but first off, I wanted to introduce my first guest right off. William Weld is in the studio this morning. He's the former governor of Massachusetts. He has had many highlights on his resume, including he headed up the criminal division in the U.S. Justice Department for a while. He is now a presidential candidate looking to run in the Republican primaries against the incumbent Donald Trump. And we'll be talking with Governor Weld this morning about his reason for running, and obviously it's a long shot, and what he thinks about that, and et cetera. So let's get right into it. Good morning, Governor. Thanks for joining me.
Dave, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
And so tell us a little bit about your – let me first ask the obvious question. Do you have any realistic plan to topple the incumbent president here in the primaries?
I do. It starts in New England. It starts with the New Hampshire primary, and there have been a number of presidents who, when they faced a primary competition there, either dropped out or lost a general election. I remember the one I was involved in was Pat Buchanan against George Bush 41 back in 92. Pat got 37% of the vote in New Hampshire, but that was the beginning of the end for George Bush 41, who a little bit earlier had been 91% favorable after the first Gulf War. So that's not a vain exercise. I climbed, if you want to call it that, 25 points against the president in New Hampshire over the course of the last month or so. And, you know, give me another one of those,
you'll be in the game.
Dead heat. Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
So and then New Hampshire is a crossover state that allows undeclared voters, independents, to vote in the Republican primary. And my message in that state, even to Democrats, is come on in and vote in the Republican primary if you're not satisfied with the president's performance. I'm getting a lot of traction there with that. And, of course, Vermont's my favorite of all, because there you don't have to re-register if you're a Democrat to vote in the Republican primary. So I'm all about trying to get more people, millennials, women, minorities, not too many in northern New England, but around the country, to vote in the Republican primary.
Yeah, of course, Vermont, with its open primary, anybody who normally considers themselves a Democrat, and this kind of thing happens occasionally. You'll get complaints that it sort of amounts to cross-party mischief sometimes in a gubernatorial race or something like that, where folks are trying to, quote-unquote, help the other party select their nominee and that kind of thing. But you actually think that this is an opportunity for Vermonters to make a statement in the context of the Republican primary about how the race ought to
Well,
shape
I
up.
Do. I mean, people, let's be candid. People have strong feelings about Mr. Trump one way or the other.
Yeah.
And for people who are not satisfied with the performance down there, they can cast a vote that will be against Mr. Trump early on. And then if they're, say, Democrats, they can make their own decision which Democrat to support in the final.
You have a very interesting background, both in terms of your public corruption in work or investigating public corruption. That is, you started out very early in your career as an investigator on the House Judiciary Committee during the Watergate investigation.
I
think one of your colleagues there was a young woman named Hillary Rodham, as I recall.
We shared an office, and we actually together wrote the law memo about what is grounds for impeachment and removal of a president back in the 1970s.
So in some ways, your appearance on the scene here is rather timely in that regard. You also have some extensive background as the head of the Justice Department's criminal division. You were assistant attorney general for that division for a time, and had worked in the U.S. Attorney's office in Massachusetts, I think, during the heyday of the Winter Hill Gang and Whitey Bulger and all that stuff.
That's right. That's right. And all thanks to Ronald Reagan.
So you you have been around the nexus of maybe politics and criminality, some. Is that a fair description, do you think?
Yes, it is. And I spent 7 years trying to keep politics out of law enforcement, so I don't like to see it creep back in.
And criminality out of politics, one would think, as well.
That's right.
But so here we are. What is your fundamental assessment here? I mean, what is going on with this president in your estimation?
I think it's a fellow who, when he was a real estate developer in New York, had a view that the law and lawyers and enforcement, that was a pesky thing to be, you know, swatted away with phalanxes of lawyers. So he's never really been a guy who thought, I like the rule of law. He's been a guy who thought, how do I get away from this? How do I get around this? And unfortunately, that mindset has followed him into the White House, and we see him really unable to conform his conduct to any requirements of law or rules or norms. I mean, his obstruction of justice, ordering people to lie and file phony documents to try to make the Mueller investigation go away, that's the strongest evidence of obstruction of justice that I've ever seen. And I've prosecuted a bunch of those cases and supervised a lot more. And 2,000 former federal prosecutors, career guys, signed a letter saying that they would absolutely indict on this evidence. So that's point one. And then you get the international stuff, Ukraine and all that. And that's point two. If I was advising the House of Representatives now what to do, I'd say keep it simple. But you got it right there with those two points.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The Mueller investigation has really kind of faded into people's minds. It's become a smaller blip on the radar screen. But when you go back to that point that these former federal prosecutors were essentially saying these are indictable offenses that Mr. Mueller has listed.
They're not only indictable, they're a laydown in terms of the evidence.
They are they're convictable, eminently
right,
convictable.
Right.
And, well, there's another question here, which I have to ask you, since you've been around this stuff for so long. I recently saw a tabulation from Wikipedia, and I know that Wikipedia is sometimes a little rough around the edges because it's edited essentially by anybody who wants to. So take it with a small grain of salt. But even if it's off by a little bit, there's such a striking thing going on here. There's a tally that indicates that in the last 50 years since the opening year of the Nixon administration, there have been 114 criminal convictions connected with presidential administrations. 113 of them have been connected with Republican presidential administrations. And with your background, I have to ask you, why are you a Republican?
I grew up a Republican. I've been a Republican since I was 18 years old, except for a couple years dalliance with the Libertarians, which I don't regret. I'm from the Libertarian side of the Republican Party, not the movement conservative, social conservative side. When I grew up and when I first went to work in Washington, it was a time of a lot of moderate Republicans who worked with Democrats, got a lot of things done. My first boss was Senator Jack Javits of New York, who was a liberal Republican. And I had a good time with it. And when people gave a speech in the Senate in those days, the galleries would be filled with other people listening who wanted to be persuaded, wanted to hear the argument. Now, if somebody gives a big speech in the Senate, it's done at 3 a.m. And, you know, the rules of C-SPAN are they can't take the camera off the person's face. So you don't see it. It's an empty, dark chamber.
Yeah.
It's all for politics. It's all palaver. It's not a serious effort to persuade anybody. And that's something I'd love to try to fix, is that the R's and the D's in Washington just hate each other. And they demonize each other so their own base can give them enough money so they get reelected. And that's really the name of the game. And then, you know, they come back in, they've all been reelected. They say, now let's tackle that budget. We'll raise everything 20% every year.
Is some of that hatred and that sort of demonization, is that as a result of what we've had in the media in the last 20, 30 years with, you know, Rush Limbaugh?
I think the turning point was the 1994 election. I used to hang out with Jack Kemp and Newt Gingrich prior to 94, and the Democrats gave Newt a saloon door on his office so that he couldn't have a private meeting. And I believe Mr. Gingrich did not forget that when he became Speaker of the House. Now, I was a Newt guy all the way in those days, but I date the acrimony to there, and obviously the gerrymandering, which has created more extreme districts, doesn't help either. But the partisan rancor, we had none of that in Massachusetts, none of it. You know, my first month, I said to the Speaker and the Senate President, why don't we meet for tea and cookies once a week? We'll start in the Speaker's office, and then we'll go to the Senate President's office, and then we can do it in my office. But we'll just chat about either jokes or the great issues of the day. Well, we did that every day for my two terms, and it wound up being almost all jokes and not the great issues of the day. But that meant we got along. And when you do that, and you know you're going to do it again within a week, it's harder to stab somebody in the back or tell the press that the guy's a jerk. And it worked very well. And they need that in Washington. Bring back Speaker Sam Rayburn and the Board of Education meetings at 5 p.m.
The over a couple of cocktails, for sure. The Mike Mansfield and George Aiken famously had a regular weekly breakfast back in the day. Of course, Aiken was from Vermont, and so a lot of Vermonters are familiar with that story. But that was a classic case of a Vermont Republican and a Montana Democrat.
Yeah. No, I knew them both well. They were both there when I worked for Javits Grateman.
Yep.
Aitkins was the one who said, I'll never vote against the presidential nominee. The president has the right to appoint who he wants, and then we'll judge their performance in office. Boy, has that point of view died out.
Yeah, that was a different time back then, I guess, or something. I'm not sure. But speaking of the big issues of the day, we really have to talk a little bit about probably more than we have time for, really, but about the Middle East here. This announcement by the president last week that he was doing this sudden troop drawdown in Syria has really, it seems to have, with amazing speed, devolved into a very serious, dangerous, and ugly situation over there. How would you extract us from that now?
Well, Syria's been a mess for a long time. The problem with what the president did is he just left the Kurds, who are our allies over there, high and dry at a time when he had to know damn well, because he talks to Erdogan all the time. Erdogan in Turkey is basically an alt-right guy, and the president keeps up his relationships with the alt-right people, not only in countries like Turkey, but in Western Europe. There are alt-right parties, and the president has been in touch with them since 2005, 2006. You know, it's a long simmering project of his. He's actually run for president several times. It just never took until this last time. So that was the problem. And right now, the Kurds had to go to Assad to try to avoid being slaughtered. So that means that the people who are benefiting from this are Assad's sponsors, who are Iran and Russia. And Iran is just smiling ear to ear, as Mitt Romney said in a tweet yesterday. So once again, the president has managed things in such a way that redounds to the benefit of Russia, not so much the United States.
Is there any way to put this genie back in the bottle?
No, I think it's a tough one. But, you know, the president's not distressed because his guy Erdogan and his guy Putin are doing well here. And the president has a long track record in office of insulting our allies, our NATO allies, and just everybody, and ripping up treaties that would be beneficial to us, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I thought ripping up the 2015 Iran deal was a colossal blunder, because at least we had them not developing their nuclear weapons program for 10 years. Now that's gone, and the president realizes, I think, that was an error, because now he's saying, I'll relax my sanctions, just let me get back at the table and talk to President Rouhani. Well, if he hadn't ripped up the treaty, he wouldn't have to do that in the first place.
Obviously, there's been an awful lot of overlap in the Mueller investigation, and even since then, in kind of what the Justice Department is up to currently under the direction of Attorney General William Barr. And how do you see? Are you worried about what some people point to as too much influence by the president over the Justice Department, insufficient independence?
Oh, sure. I spent my 5 years as U.S. attorney, my 2 years as head of the criminal division. My number one priority was prosecuting public corruption and keeping politics out of the Justice Department. If you have politics in the Justice Department, then you're not living by their motto, which is do justice without fear or favor. If that function is politicized, by definition, you're acting with favor for your side. And I regret to say this, because Bill Barr was a good, strong AG under President George Bush 41. But he has, I think, bought into the president's view that the attorney general exists to cover the political skirts of the president. That is not true. The attorney general represents the American people. And once that function gets politicized, we're all in big trouble, because that's the ultimate law enforcement authority.
And the president of the United States has there's the White House counsel. He has his own private lawyer now, Rudy Giuliani. You're actually Giuliani's former boss at one point, is that right?
And vice versa. You know, he appointed me, so I owe Rudy. He gave me my start as U.S. attorney. Then I became head of the criminal division, so I was his nominal superior. But you couldn't prove that through Rudy, for sure.
He's not testifying to that.
That's okay. Right.
So, what do you think about his recent role in all of these international diplomacy or semi-diplomacy or shadow diplomacy, whatever you call it?
It's sort of odd. You know, he and Bill Barr both seem to have new hats on, but Rudy says everything he's doing is for his clients. So I'm just going to wait and see on that one. I do think that AG Barr has taken on some pretty extreme positions. I mean, he's told the president and the world that he thinks if a president exercises a power which is granted to the president under Article 2 of the Constitution, you can't go beyond behind that and ask why he exercised it. So like if he granted somebody a pardon, you can't even talk about why. Well, what if it was in exchange for a $10 million bribe? You know, the AG's logic would say, no, you can't get into that or else the president would be answering questions all the time. We couldn't run a world out there. That's ridiculous. That would mean that, corruption of an office and use of the public office of president for private gain, which the president does all the time, by the way, is permissible. It's not. It's very criminal. And I think the AG and the president together think, oh, no, that's not only not criminal. Nobody can ask us about that. It's a dangerous state of affairs.
It is it's certainly an odd state of affairs, something that is unprecedented in your memory, right? I mean,
oh, sure. I mean, nothing Nixon did was anything like this. That was a one-off. He said to Haldeman and Ehrlichman, tell them it's the CIA. They should drop this stupid Watergate investigation. Of course, he knew it would lead to the White House, so that was not a good thing, but it was like one conversation. And whereas, you know, the president, President Trump, telling people to destroy or file phony documents and lie to Congress, and nobody can dispute that because they all say that's right. We said we can't lie, and he said, "What's your point?" Because he thinks lying is fine if it benefits himself.
It really is we're in very strange times here, folks, and there's just no way around that. I mean, I guess your hope here, if you think you have any chance of winning the Republican nomination and becoming the next president, Donald Trump would be out of office. Would he then be prosecutable, and should he end up in jail?
Well, the Constitution says in no uncertain terms that if a president is removed from office or leaves office, he shall remain liable to indictment, prosecution, and punishment after he leaves office. So that's a yes.
So you're thinking there's enough there that this current president would be the first one, I assume, definitely, to end up actually behind bars.
Well, he has massive criminal exposure. He's someone who thinks that the law is a nuisance. Not only is he not a champion of the rule of law, he's on the other side of that one. So, yeah, sorry to say.
It really, I mean, that is a striking statement to hear any candidate. I mean, I suppose, you know, we heard the chants at the rallies, lock her up. And so in that sense, it has happened before that a presidential candidate has come out and said another politician should be in jail. But it seems as though this is a much more serious set of allegations here than anything that ever happened. I say to my Republican friends sometimes when they say that Hillary's as corrupt as Trump or whatever, I say, well, there are some differences here. One is that nobody's actually been able to pin anything on her.
Yeah, I never really got the email stuff as being a significant national issue. But the thing that I just quoted about remain liable to indictment, prosecution, punishment, that's in the U.S. Constitution. So you can't get around that. And no president can say this doesn't apply to me. It's in the Constitution.
In the Constitution. Well, we have could go on for hours here, folks. There's so many different angles we could follow here in terms of what has been going on with the current administration. And Bill Weld has obviously got a lot of knowledge in terms of an ability to critique various aspects of it from the point of view of a former federal prosecutor and the point of view of somebody who's been in government himself. And it really is a fascinating opportunity here. But you have some events coming up here, and I am looking for them here. Struggling to find them.
I'm going from here. I'm going to meet with the UVermont Republicans, and then we have a 2:30 presidential town hall. I think that's in South Burlington. And then I end today with Washington County with a dinner there from 5 to 7. And you're going to be seeing a lot of me here because, like I say, this is my favorite New England state because Democrats can vote in the Republican primary.
Okay, we just have a minute to go. I have to ask you one thing about New England politics. Paul Tsongas won the New Hampshire primary. The Ed Muskie won the New Hampshire primary. They seem to favor New Englanders over there, don't they?
Well, I tell people these days I'm a New England Republican, and in Vermont and Massachusetts, New Hampshire, they know what I mean. It means fiscal conservative, socially liberal.
All right. Governor Bill Weld, thanks so much for coming in this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave. It's an honor.
We're going to take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show for some bottom of the hour CBS news and be back with more of the program to follow. Stay with us, folks.
Fall. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, and next half hour or so, I want to open the phone lines here on the Dave Graham Show and let listeners weigh in. We just heard very interesting perspective on things from Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, who is running in Republican primaries against President Trump. That would be a tall order to knock off the incumbent president, who has many Republicans living in fear of him, and not Bill Weld. He is somebody who has been pretty fearless at times in his career. He was a longtime federal prosecutor going after mob bosses and other people who might put on a pretty tough front from time to time. But he got right in there and mixed it up with them back in the day, including he was working in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston back during the days of the ascendancy of the Winter Hill Gang, Whitey Bulger and all those guys. And So he's had quite a career. In addition to politics, he has been in that in the Justice Department. And anyway, he's on the scene now as a candidate for president. He's looking for folks here in Vermont to come out and support him. What do you think, listeners? 244-1777, 1-877-291-8255. I know there are a number of supporters of President Trump in our DEV listener base here. And is it okay for somebody to come along as a Republican and perhaps put a little pressure on the president in primary season? Or should that not be happening? There are, I think, four states now, including leading with Arizona and at least three others, I believe, that have said they're not going to hold Republican primaries because they believe that the president should have clear sailing right to the nomination and for reelection next summer. And Governor Weld is pretty much not going to be, I would think, very active in places like Arizona because if they're not going to hold a primary, why bother, right? So, but he says he loves Vermont because Vermont has got an open primary where people can cross from one party to another. You might think of yourself historically as a Democrat, and come primary day next March, town meeting day, you can vote in either the Democratic or Republican primary. You can't mix and match. You got to pick one ballot, one or the other. And then you, once you have selected the ballot, you can vote for, if it's a Republican ballot, either Donald Trump or Bill Weld or Mark Sanford, the former governor of South Carolina also running in the Republican primaries, as well as Joe Walsh, a former congressman from Illinois. So Joe Walsh, not to be confused with the guy who drives his Maserati at 185. Anyway, let's see here. Rama on the line from Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, good morning. I'd like to say my wife is terribly unfair to me, but that's probably the subject of another phone call. Hey, you know, something that Mr. Weld said about the president's, you know, he has a right to the cabinet appointees that he wants.
Well, he was, and I think he was quoting George Aiken saying that.
Yeah, but he was doing that in an approving manner. So mm-hmm. I assume that when you quote something in a way that you agree with it, that
yep.
you're saying that too, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, this goes back to something I called up before a couple days ago, that, you know, the president does not have a right to the cabinet of his choosing. The Constitution says that the president can nominate somebody. And remember now, Mr. Weld's great adherence to the Constitution on certain of these issues, the Constitution also states very explicitly that it, you know, these cabinet positions are appointed with the advice and consent of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I really, it bothers me so much when I hear these things. This is the seeds of royalty and authoritarianism, et cetera. And, you know, all parties have taken this up, you know, that for some reason the highest elected official has the right to something or another. And they don't. They represent us. We have, as people, we have the rights, you know, not the government. So I just wanted to call up because that really bothered me when I heard him say that, because that's just a continuation of this. Oh, my gosh, the president is just this royal character who deserves to get what he wants.
All right, Rama, thanks for the call. I think it's an interesting point. I guess there actually is an interesting question there in terms of what does advice and consent mean. The plain meaning you would think consent would be you've actually got to agree. You know, in other contexts you hear about consent in terms of sexual encounters, and it really means that both parties to a sexual encounter actually need to agree that this is what we want to do and get at it. If there's any wavering of consent or lack of consent, et cetera, that is that's a lot of the subject of the Me Too movement these days. So there's a context in which consent is really, I'd say, maximized in the context of an appointment to a cabinet position in the government or to a Supreme Court justice. Does consent mean that strong a volition on the part of the other party and a willingness on the part of the other party, or is the proper attitude of the Senate when considering who's going to be the next Secretary of Labor or whatever it is the proper attitude of the Senate to give a lot of leeway to the President of the United States? My own sense of this is probably that if it really depends kind of on what the job is the person's being appointed to. The greatest leeway would probably be on something like an executive branch department head, you know, as I mentioned, a Secretary of Labor, Secretary of Commerce, an Attorney General. The president, I think, historically, traditionally, has been largely allowed to put together his or her own team unless there's some real strong reason to say, you know, let's give this thing some serious pushback if the next Republican president comes out and tries to appoint Rudolph Giuliani as Attorney General, you may have some pushback from the Senate about that, just for one speculative example. And the other end of the spectrum on this stuff might be, you know, probably would be Supreme Court appointments, because now we're talking about not an executive branch appointment, but a completely separate branch of the government, that being the judiciary. We're talking about a lifetime appointment to for someone who is going to be playing a very, very important role in determining what the law of the land really is. And so Historically, certainly in our lifetimes here, last 30 or 40 years anyway, Supreme Court justice nominations have been very heavily scrutinized by the United States Senate, in one case at least, I think, completely bottled up, that being the case of Merrick Garland in the last year of the Obama administration. And the seat was held over in hopes by Mitch McConnell and other Republicans that a Republican would be elected president. And sure enough, that wish came true. And so there is a lot of Senate pushback oftentimes on a Republican nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, less so in jobs like cabinet positions and so on. Let's go to Fred in Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. If I'm correct, I think Jimmy Carter was the last incumbent president to lose re-election in recent history. Is that true?
I think you're missing George H.W. Bush.
George H.W. Bush. Okay, so two of them lost.
Uh-huh.
Two incumbent presidents lost.
Right, right? One of each party.
Okay, so it looks like the probability of Trump losing is going to be close to 50-50 in the primary. He'll win the primary because I don't think anybody can challenge him. But in the general election, it looks like Elizabeth Warren is probably going to be the person is going to run against the president in the general election. But I think for her to win, she's going to have to swing more to the central left. Right now, she's too far to the left, but she'll win the primary. But the general election is going to force her to be a lot more moderate. And if she can't be more moderate, I think Trump will probably win.
Was Trump forced to be moderate when he ran in 2016, or is that push to be more moderate only apply to Democrats?
It applies to everybody. But I think the reason why Trump won in 16 was because of the so-called forgotten man.
Okay, but I guess I'm trying to get from you, Fred, to find out whether you think that it's really more a matter of a lot of folks out there are saying that Trump won in part because he ran pretty hard to the right and really stated some very, very clear positions. And if you state your positions clearly and simply, then you're in better shape than somebody who is constantly trying to sort of trim one's sails, so to speak.
But you got a point there.
Yep.
The other point I think was that the voters were fed up with Hillary, and she mm-hmm. ran a poor election. And they weren't particularly fed up with Hillary; they're fed up she was around too much. I mean, she was in the news all the time, and enough was enough. And so that put an end to her. So I think she was her worst enemy. Whereas coming up now, Elizabeth is going to be his major. I mean, she is going to give him a run for his money, but I don't think middle America is going to vote for her because she's too far to the left. She's going to have to modify more in the general election. And if she can do that, then it's going to be a real election. It'll be an all-nighter.
It matters, though, doesn't it, the incumbent's record?
Yeah, it does. But if you look at his record right now, I mean, middle America's going to say, hey, look, I got money in my pocket, I can spend, you know, the consumer confidence is good, so on and so forth. And then they look at it and they say, okay, why is the country so polarized? Well, they're going to say the Democrats have polarized the country.
So this money in your pocket, Fred, let me ask you about this. Usually when the economy is good, the government is running a surplus. I mean, that's what happened during the dot-com boom in the 90s when Bill Clinton was president.
That's the only one.
We erased budget deficits that were left over from the Reagan era and actually moved a little bit into surplus, if I recall correctly. In times of economic downturn, the government spends additional money to try to basically goose the economy and pump it up a little bit. Okay, so now we have the president of the United States who's telling us that we have the greatest economy in the history of the country, right? That's what the president is saying this every day. Meanwhile, The Congressional Budget Office last week came out with new numbers indicating that the current fiscal year deficit on the federal budget is going to approach $1 trillion. It was like $987 billion, I believe, or somewhere in there.
Right.
And so when you say that people have money in their pocket, maybe is it more accurate to say that people have a credit card in their pocket?
Okay, so but you're talking about the national debt. Okay, here's the issue with the national debt. You know, Clinton was an exception, but every incumbent president has got a national debt problem, and that incumbent president doesn't care, and neither does the people that support him, and then it works vice versa. The national debt is a major issue. And right now, everybody is looking the other way and pretending that they got their so-called head in the sand as far as the national debt is concerned.
Well, I'm going to urge on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV that people pull their heads out of the sand, because this is very serious business. Now, listen, Obama ran a couple of trillion-dollar annual deficits and added significantly to the national debt. That was immediately after. The greatest economic crash since the Great Depression. Okay, the recession of 2008, 2009 was just the economy was teetering on the brink of breadlines. Okay, and Obama wanted to try to rescue the car industry, wanted to try to rescue these banks, and okay, so you spend a lot of borrowed money. That's what the government does. This time we have what the president says is the greatest economy in history, and we're borrowing money like Obama did early in his term. I don't think it adds up, frankly. I think there's something really, really off kilter here, and I think the people ought to really pause and consider whether this is good strategy. Let's go to Gene from Barry. Good morning, Gene.
Good morning. What a wet day.
Yeah.
If the economy is doing so good, how come we're only going to get an increase of 1.6 in our Social Security in January? This year, we got 2.8. I got $31 increase. In January, I'm only going to get $18 more.
Well, I think that's a good question, Gene. I don't have an answer for you. Other than... The policy that determines eventually how Social Security pays out is set by the Congress in conjunction with the president as part of the federal deficit, or the federal budget, I should say.
Yeah.
And there is some concern about federal spending right now. Are we spending too much money and putting our younger folks into debt? And if we doubled the amount of the increase for our older folks, you'd get, what, $62 instead of $31, and but can the country afford that right now? I mean, I think it's a matter of setting priorities and trying to figure out how the federal government's money gets doled out. I mean, that's the basis central thing in politics.
Yeah, but he says the economy's getting better. I can't see how it's getting better. Look in Wall Street. It's going down, all the stuff more than it's going up.
Yeah, it seems to be a fairly bouncy ride down there. I think over the course of the whole year, I was just looking at my retirement account last night, and it looks like it's grown a little bit this year. So one hopes that will be the case over time.
Yeah.
And that's certainly the way it's advertised. And that's why we do it.
Yeah. We'll just have to wait and see what's going to happen.
Yeah. Gene, what do you think about Bill Weld? Do you think that he's got he's got anything to say here, or is he just on a fool's errand, or what?
What was he saying?
Well, he's a former Republican governor of Massachusetts. He's running against Trump.
Oh, yeah, I heard that.
In the
yeah.
Republican primary. He was our first guest this morning. I don't know if you caught any of that, but he's a very interesting guy. He's got quite a straightforward expectation of what the government ought to be doing, and he thinks that the norm breaking and the law breaking by the current president, Bill Weld, believes that Donald Trump is going to should end up in jail for his various activities while in office.
I think a lot of us know that he should, because of all these different things he's done and whatever.
Okay. Well, Gene, I appreciate the call. I got to jump, but I appreciate it, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot. Just a few minutes to go on this block of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And if you want to hear what Bill Weld had to say in the first half hour of the program this morning, but you were unable to check us out because you were busy doing other stuff, maybe. I know this does happen, folks, so I won't hold it against you. In fact, I'll hold it for you with our podcast, and that is the place you can go on the internet, wdevradio.com. Follow the link from the station's homepage to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit, and you can find a list of our recent programs. And so if you wanted to hear what Bill Weld, quite an entertaining fellow. He's put on a very interesting performance, I thought, this morning in the first half hour of the show. When Bill Weld is our guest, I think quite a number of people sit up to pay attention a little bit. But if you couldn't hear it, go to the podcast and check that out. Time for one or two more calls here before the top of the hour. Let's 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury, 1-877-291-8255. And the tragedy continues to unfold in Syria here. People are dying over there now that weren't a couple of weeks ago because there was a U.S. force there able to kind of keep its thumb on the powder keg or something. I don't know exactly what the right metaphor is there, but it wasn't. And then the president announced last week all of a sudden U.S. troops are going to stand down and withdraw from northern Syria. That opened the door for a Turkish invasion where the Turks are going after the Kurds there. Of course, the Kurds were helping the United States keep a lid on ISIS over there for a while. So it was really kind of like a game of pickup sticks. If you pull out the wrong stick, things are going to collapse sometimes. And it seems to be that is what has happened in the northern part of Syria now. It's a real mess. And anyway, folks, so we are in about the last minute here of the first hour of the Dave Graham Show for this Thursday morning. And I wanted to mention that after the break, we're going to be hearing from folks from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, our weekly Seeds to Society segment. We're going to be talking about farm labor issues here in Vermont. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toton Code, Fashion Forward, Tonya DeBellis, and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are continuing into the second hour of our program this morning, and Thursdays are our Seeds to Society Day, the second hour of the Thursday program we are devoting throughout this fall and maybe into the winter. See how it goes in terms of how many subjects we can come up with. But the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont has been very helpful recently in coming up with topics to talk about relating to everything agriculture and then some. Subjects range from things like we actually did our first program with them several weeks ago now. It was a discussion about bringing sheep into a winery. The Shelburne Winery was bringing in sheep to keep its weeds and grass down in between the grape rows there. And after a while, you got to get the sheep out of there because then they can reach up and get some of the nice, fat, juicy grapes. And you don't want that to happen. But at various times of the season, bring in the sheep and get the weeds down. And it just struck me as I was very curious about it on a personal level because I was thinking about maybe borrowing a couple of these sheep from my yard. But anyway, a whole range of subjects. We're going to be talking about the U.S. Census. We've talked about any number of other things related to agriculture in straight on and maybe sometimes somewhat tangential ways, but so much is related to agriculture. Last week, the subject was moose genetics. So many, many things are under study up there at the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at UVM. And this week, the subject is going to be the farm labor issues that Vermont faces. Vermont dairy farms are famously struggling to find enough workers. One result has been a real influx of folks from Mexico to work on the farms in Vermont, and that has raised a whole host of issues related to immigration, et cetera. And we're going to be talking about some of those issues with my guests this morning. Dan Baker has been studying this issue with the University of Vermont. He's working to help build a stronger and more resilient, sustainable rural economy. That's been a lifelong goal for Dan, and his research includes work on dairy labor issues, including interviews with dairy farmers and migrant Latinx farm workers. He is seeking to address long-term labor shortages in the dairy industry in Vermont. Good morning, Dan. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And in a few minutes, I believe we are going to be hearing, from Naomi Walcott McCausland, who grew up on a small farm in Franklin County, Vermont, spent 4 years living and working in Central America with a focus on rural health, returned to Vermont 10 years ago and began working with the Migrant Education Program of the UVM Extension before shifting her focus to an unmet need, access to health care services for immigrant farm workers. So I'm hoping we can be getting Naomi on the line in the next few minutes and have her checking in with us as well. But let's start with you, Dan. You've been interviewing really discrete groups here. You mentioned you've been interviewing the farm workers. You've been interviewing farm owners as well as members of the public about mm-hmm. the various issues connected with farm labor in Vermont and what are you finding? First off, let me ask you about farm workers' interests and attitudes and other discussions with them in terms of their what they're seeing and feeling out there on the farm.
So from farm workers, most of our farm workers are from Mexico. We've got an increasing number from Guatemala and some from a smaller number from other countries in Central America. They tend to be young. They tend to be male. They've generally not been here that long.
Mm-hmm.
Although in recent years, we're now seeing the length of stay increasing because it becomes more difficult to travel back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But Dave, I could just back up like why we see an increased number of farm workers.
Yeah. Why do Vermont dairy farmers hire the labor from south of the border? What is going on there?
Cool. So I've been working on this for more than 10 years. And in 2010, we interviewed 73 dairy farmers about the availability of U.S. workers.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2010, more than three quarters said that there was a shortage of U.S. workers. When we asked the same question in 2018, it's actually gotten more difficult. 86% said there was a shortage of U.S. workers to work on dairy farms. The Latino or Latinx workers right now are kind of meeting that critical need and really helping keep a lot of our farms in business.
And why do you think it is that there's a shortage of workers? Is it simple, not enough bodies, not enough people, or is it more a matter of the work is difficult and there are other opportunities open to people who are native to Vermont to get out into our economy and do other stuff?
That's a great question. It's a complex question. I think we've been talking about it for years. I remember like in 2010, where there was a little working group and we talked about just doing a better job marketing the jobs on dairies. It is hard work. It is long hours, but it also pays well. It's got some flexibility. I think there is a potential to increase the number of workers, you know, through better marketing. However, people in general have shifted away from ag labor, and this is part of a larger trend in the United States. And it is consistently and more difficult to get U.S. workers.
And the experience for farmers. What do farmers tell you about their experiences with hiring folks from Mexico and Guatemala, et cetera?
So farmers are very, very happy with their Latino, Latinx workers. They're also happy with their U.S. workers. They just can't get enough of them. We find that, what I always think is surprising is how well things seem to work on dairy farms, given the situation that most of our dairy farmers don't speak Spanish, and most of our foreign workers, Latinx workers, don't speak. Most of our dairy farmers don't speak Spanish, and most of our workers don't speak English, and somehow they are able to make it work.
And I wanted to bring in Naomi. We introduced Naomi a few moments ago. Naomi, you grew up on a dairy farm in Vermont, is that right?
I did, a very small dairy farm, 20 to 25 milkers.
And is your farm still in your family?
That is an interesting question this month. So, yes, kind of. So the land is in our family. We just transitioned to a lease with a young couple who has progressively been buying the herd.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are using our land base and the farm, but the cows now are theirs. So it's still operating as a dairy farm, but my parents have stepped back from the day-to-day operations, or are trying to.
And what is their experience and your experience with finding folks to work on the farm?
At that size farm, we really, until the young couple that I mentioned, it's been family. So I milked for a number of years. My husband has milked. My brother has milked. My sister's occasionally covered to allow very minimal but important vacations. So we've never had to experience a labor shortage because it's all come from within.
That's sort of the traditional picture a lot of people have of old-time Vermont dairy farmers, where they had big families and they all took a turn with the chores and so. But that has changed in recent years. Farms have gotten larger and more mechanized. And what are you seeing out there in terms of that whole trend?
So that's certainly something, Dan, you could probably speak more to based on your research. You know, from my perspective, there are still small family farms, but they are not as prolific as the larger, medium-sized and larger farms. Certainly we've grown in terms of the size of dairy farms in Vermont.
And Dan, let me ask you about that sense of what's going on the farm out there. Farms are getting bigger, more mm-hmm. mechanized. There are, and a lot of the jobs that are happening on farms, it's really more like a factory than an old-time farm than it used to be, isn't it? Or
yeah, without factory being a pejorative, without being a negative, it is what they are. Many of our farms are milking on three times a day, so it's a very regular, long routine. It's different than in the past. You know, it's not just morning and evening milking.
Right.
And kind of that sort of steady demand for milkers, that's really where the migrant workers have filled in. They're overwhelmingly the ones milking in the parlor. A lot of U.S. workers are working on machinery, working out doing crop work, doing managerial tasks.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the migrant Latino workers working on our farms now. In terms of, first off, numbers, Vermont has X number of farm workers on dairy farms. What percentage of them are Latino or Latinx?
It's hard to say a percentage. I'd say for farms that hire off non-family labor,
mm-hmm.
so not our smaller farms, our larger farms, the majority of those farms hire Latinx workers and depend on them.
Yeah. And for the farm owners, I mean, one issue here obviously is the language barrier. We have people coming up that speak Spanish, no English. The old farm families in Vermont who own these properties oftentimes don't have much Spanish. And so how's that work out?
Yeah, it's amazing. In when we first started doing the study back in 2010, and we'd say to farmers, like, how are you communicating with the workers? How are the workers communicating with you? A lot of times it was literally with hand signals. Since 2010, we've seen more greater availability of translators, both through the Vermont Migrant Education Program at UVM Extension, the program Puentes that Naomi's involved in does kind of medical translation, and Naomi can talk more about that, mm-hmm. as well as feed dealers and nutritionists and vets who provide some translation services.
And that's really becoming a booming mini industry in itself in Vermont these days. I mean, I know a number of young folks who speak Spanish, and they're finding work translating in the farm environment as well as actually working there. And so how do you think the farm owners and the families that have been on the farm for generations are adapting themselves? Is there a phenomenon out there of farmers who are studying Spanish?
Oh, yeah.
And working their vocabulary in the evenings?
There's farmers that study Spanish. There's farmers who have gone and visited Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
I know farmers who have long and close relationships with their workers, take them out for recreation.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, Dave. Given the challenges of having a Spanish-speaking dairy workforce in Vermont, you know, close to the border, the language barriers, the cold, the isolation. Given all of that, we've been surprised to see that the stress levels amongst the workers is lower than you might expect relative to other states. We're about in the middle of the range of studies of stress,
mm-hmm.
And that's not to minimize the stress workers are under. About 30% of the workers we surveyed in 2016 scored at a level that would indicate clinical stress, and that is a real serious problem.
How does that compare with the native worker population?
The survey that we did. It's a great question. The survey that we did was specifically developed for Spanish-speaking migrant workers in other states, and that's the one we've used. I do think that it actually turns out to be a little harder to survey U.S. workers than to survey some of the Latino workers. U.S. dairy workers are busy. They got a lot going on. Getting them to stop for an interview is challenging. We did do it in 2010. We mm-hmm. haven't done it. We haven't interviewed the U.S. workers since then.
Let's bring in a caller. We have Karen on the line from Hardwick. Good morning, Karen.
I'd just like to point out that the reason for the low price of milk and the disappearance of the farm is basically overproduction and allowing these people to bring in cheap illegal labor to further overproduce. It's just not right.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, Karen. That's an interesting perspective you bring there. What do you think, Dan? Is this bringing in immigrant labor? Is it promoting overproduction? And is that one of the key problems in our dairy industry these days?
Yeah. Well, so there's several questions there.
Yeah.
There is a problem of overproduction. I think in the news this morning, they were talking about Vermont starting to look at and perhaps implement milk supply supply management, which could, we hope, help increase and stabilize milk prices. There's also, I think, a broader shift away from agriculture in the United States and a consequent labor problem. I think it asks a lot on an individual farmer to buck a trend as they're trying to stay in business, and we know that most of our farms are really struggling to stay in business,
mm-hmm.
to say that you are going to survive and somehow not have enough people to produce the milk that you need to produce to stay in business.
Yeah, there's a lot of chicken and egg type stuff going on here, it seems. It's really, it can be a difficult balancing act, and that's got to be one of the stresses for the whole environment, including the workers as well as the owners of the farms. Another source of stress is the whole question of health care for workers. Farm work is famously dangerous, but first, we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Judy in Williamstown. Good morning, Judy.
I would just like to make the comment that we were dairy farmers for 52 years and did it all just with a family.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't hire any outside help, and we milk about 50 to 52, well, 55 cows usually.
Mm-hmm.
We had a guy from the University of Vermont come down and sit right at our table and tell us that we couldn't make it. Being a small farm, we had to increase our herd and get bigger. And this was what the state of Vermont promoted, was bigger farms, larger farms.
Hmm.
And I think that it's come back to bite them, because when you get rid of all your smaller farms, you don't have the land being used. It's all going to brush. And I feel that they're the ones that created the problem. And as far as the migrant workers, if it's illegal for them to be here, they should not be here.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, Judy. I appreciate that. Dan, let me just ask you to quickly address this concern that Vermont's farms are getting bigger, whether it's due to a push by the state or by maybe UVM Extension, or I don't know who out there is promoting larger farms, if anybody, but is there a point at which farmers are finding that their farms get just large enough that their families can't do it anymore and they have to hire extra labor?
Yeah, I think the issue of farms increasing in size is not a state issue. It's an industry issue, and it goes across state borders. You know, we ship, milk outside the state. We depend on our outside markets. The scale of farming has increased. The dairy farmers that I speak with, most of them don't want to be working the hours that they're working. I think that they would prefer to be a little bit smaller, many of them. I don't want to speak for all of them. But they all want to stay in business, and they're doing what they need to do to stay in business. And a lot of times that is decreasing the cost of a hundredweight of milk by producing more milk.
And let's go to Naomi Walcott McCausland for a few minutes just to check in with you about healthcare issues. One of the big issues on a farm, obviously, it's an injury-prone occupation. More so than working in an office, certainly, and folks, just any population, people need health care, and you have some programs through the University of Vermont UVM Extension to help with that. Let's give a brief introduction, and then we're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. Be back afterward to talk more about all this. But Naomi, the floor is yours. What are you up to in terms of farm worker health?
So UVM Extension is part of a 4-organization consortium that supports access to health care services for immigrant farm workers across the state. So Bi-State Primary Care Association has taken the lead since 2009 in supporting funding opportunities for outreach and making sure that farm workers have options in their local communities. And we collaborate in addition to Bi-State, and then through us at UVM Extension, we work with the Open Door Clinic. It's a free clinic out of Addison County,
mm-hmm.
and Vermont Care Partners. And so between the 4 organizations, our goal really is to make sure that farm workers have the knowledge that they need about what services are available to them. And then for individuals that may have barriers, we work on an individual family household level to decrease any given barriers for a particular health situation so that they're able to receive whatever medical care they're in need of. So that's anything from doing a 3-way call to make an appointment, helping fill out paperwork, thinking about options for transportation, for interpretation, helping to understand bills. So it kind of runs the gamut, really filling in the gaps so that they can get better and address whatever health need they're dealing with.
And do you This joint program is called Bridges to Health. Is that right?
Yes.
And I'm wondering, there's got to be some special considerations here in terms of language and so on. Do you have enough translation in the healthcare field to get it done?
So interpretation is a huge issue. Our staff is bilingual, so through UVM Extension, we have a number of individuals that work for me through Bridges to Health, but then also have other hats with the Migrant Education Program, doing outreach on the farms. So they speak Spanish. The Open Door Clinic also has members of their team that speak Spanish. Certainly, in the clinics, it is a significant challenge to have in-person interpreters, which is generally the best practice and the preference. But many of those clinics have now instituted policies where they can use phone interpretation or video interpretation.
Let's talk more about this after the break. We got to go to some CBS News at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back very shortly on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, continuing our conversation with Dan Baker and Naomi McCausland, both from the University of Vermont. This is part of our weekly Seeds to Society segment, organized with the help of the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Today's topic is labor issues on the Vermont dairy farms, and certainly there have been some big changes in farming in the last 20 or 30 years. A lot of economic pressure on the farms. There are farm trends in agriculture in which dairy farms are getting bigger. A lot of the smaller ones are the ones going out of business. The remaining farms, in many cases, are really large, and they're bringing in additional labor, many times from south of the U.S.-Mexico border. Mexico, Guatemala, places like that are the home countries of many of our farm workers in Vermont now. And Dan, you were telling me that your survey results indicate really quite a bit of public support for the idea of bringing these workers in to do this necessary labor and trying to treat them well and humanely and all that sort of thing. Tell us about some of your findings in that regard.
So, you know, overall, I've been doing public opinion surveying since 2010 through the UVM Vermonter poll.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, there's just very, very strong support for these migrant workers in Vermont. More than 70% of Vermonters we surveyed do not believe that migrant workers take jobs away from Vermonters. And actually, that opinion has actually been getting stronger in recent years. A majority, about 60%, think that the overall impact of these migrant workers on communities is positive. And I think importantly, we have very, very strong support for a legal visa program for migrant dairy workers. You know, our apple industry, some of our vegetable farmers depend on the H-2A temporary agricultural visa to pick their crops. Dairy farmers don't have that option, and more than 90% of Vermonters support a legal visa program.
The folks in Vermont accepting and willing to welcome these migrant workers into our communities and onto our farms by and large. I guess I'm not surprised by that. I still hear some occasional pushback. I mean, we had a caller from Hardwick a few minutes ago talking about this issue of the farm economy in general really experiencing some impacts, maybe less than positive impacts in her estimation, from the growing availability of this labor, increasing production and that sort of thing. Is that a view that you're picking up elsewhere, or is that a pretty unique thing to that one caller we had?
I mean, there's people, I think there's a lot of people who wish that we had a healthier dairy economy, including a lot of farmers,
mm-hmm.
who'd like to be making more money and working fewer hours and doing better.
Yeah,
as we do, as dairy farmers do over the just a couple hours over the border in Canada, and I think that's why there's been an increasing move towards supply management. But overall, I think that Vermont's really been pretty outstanding in how we have evolved and adapted to support this. This Spanish-speaking population, and I think that on the one hand, we do have a significant number of our workers, migrant workers, are really under a lot of stress. Most of those stressors are off the farm. Not all of them, but most of them are off the farm. And Vermonters have organized. We've got strong migrant farm worker advocacy organizations. We have state agencies that have changed policies to support these workers. We have health clinics like Naomi was talking about that have developed programs and outreach specifically for those workers. And all of that's in, we have fair and impartial policing to reduce some stress. And all of that's kind of within a context of a Vermonters that believe that these workers are helping keep our dairy industry alive.
You mentioned the healthcare issues, and I did have a couple more questions for Naomi on the healthcare question, and one is, Naomi, what is the most common complaint? What are the common issues that arise for migrant workers on the farm?
So we occasionally go out to the farms with medical professionals, and what we see when we're on the farm are overuse injuries, gastrointestinal issues like acid reflux, skin conditions, health issues that can get worse over time but generally are not significantly impacting workers' ability to do their job. Mm-hmm. What we see in terms of farm workers deciding to go off farm and actually seek out care in health clinics, it tends to be for more urgent and emergent health issues, so a health issue, an injury that's really interrupted their ability to work. So an abscessed tooth, not being able to sleep because of a health issue, a strain or a break as a result of an on-farm injury. So it's really, you know, we have seen change in the past few years. You know, initially workers were going home when they had significant health issues, and we are seeing individuals with chronic issues now staying and receiving care or significant health issues, but certainly it's predominantly they're going off farm if they're not able to work as a result of a health condition.
And in addition to the health conditions the workers may be facing, other stressors as well, Dan, and I wonder, one thing that I would think would be tough to get used to for somebody new to this climate is just the weathers.
Mm-hmm.
In the wintertime. I mean, walking from the housing on the farm where the migrant workers might be staying to the cow barns when it's 20 below outside and the wind's howling, got to be tough.
It is tough. And, you know, it's within the top 10 stressors. It's cold or it's rainy. That is a challenge. It's not the main thing that stresses workers out, but it is within the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, most of what stresses workers out is really coming from off the farm. The migration, the migration journey itself,
yeah,
extremely stressful. The being away from family and friends, very very stressful. Worries about being deported, very mm-hmm. stressful.
Yeah,
but weather's up there.
When in the migration journey, what's the most common method? Is it over the roads from the Mexican border, or are people going to flying to Canada and then coming south, or how are they getting here?
You know, I'll just say that my survey, we don't ask about your legal status, and we don't ask about details about your journey up here. We just ask about the level of stress.
I see.
Experience from that.
Yeah. When I hear it's a harrowing journey, it does make me go, okay, well, what actually happens during this journey that makes it unusually difficult? It's certainly not like flying home from Cancun after vacation.
No. And I think that this is not my research. This is just a few news reports, and you have a lot of people who die in the desert.
Yeah.
You've seen pictures of parents and their children drowned in the river recently.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that, and this is just from news reports, that at the southern border now we have more and more asylum seekers and migrants who are being detained.
More northern border, more active ICE and Border Patrol up here?
Well, we did in 2016. We looked at, we interviewed workers, you know, across the whole state, and we found a significantly higher level of stress if the farm you were on was within 50 miles of the border. So there's no question that the closer you are to the Canadian border, the more Border Patrol activity there is and the higher stress you feel.
There was a case a month or two ago, I believe it was up in Derby, where some migrant farm workers were shopping in a local store up there, and somebody called the police, I guess, and said, hey, there are some migrants shopping in a local store. Any message you want to share with the folks who might be tempted to make such a phone call?
Well, I think what that story speaks to is the vulnerability of these workers.
Mm-hmm.
As well as, and we don't talk about this as much, but the vulnerability of the farmers that depend on those workers. When an incident like that happens, people, a lot of times those people, those workers are in the store to either buy food for themselves and have a little bit of control over kind of what they eat.
Yep.
Or send money home to their families so that they can have their kids go to school,
mm-hmm.
pay for housing and healthcare. In the situation that we have right now, where the majority of people are supporting these workers, when a few individuals decide to report them, it causes a lot of pain and disruption for the workers, for their families, and for their employers.
When they're reported, though, the word goes to the local law enforcement agency, which may bring in ICE folks to get involved in some kind of an enforcement action or whatever. And, you know, ICE and the local police will say, we're just enforcing the law. We don't write the laws. Mm-hmm. And is the real problem here that the laws may need to be reconsidered in some respects?
Well, the thing is that you've got state laws or you have federal laws.
Yep.
And they are different. You know, here in the state of Vermont, we've got fair and impartial policing that the state police are following. I think that there's a challenge that some of the local police departments may not feel that they need to follow that law, but overall, I think some of our largest police forces, state police, follow fair and impartial policing and won't report a civil violation, like won't ask about immigration status.
Yeah, yeah.
But the federal agents in the state, they're operating on a different set of guidelines.
Sure. Let's bring in another caller. Larry from Barry's on the phone. Hey, that rhymes. Larry from Barry, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I've interacted with a number of workers that work on two local large farms and dairies here, and they seem to me to be like very hardworking, very dependable type people that are just trying to make a living for their families. So I'm just curious, when they're paid, you know, what you just mentioned, they're sending money back to their homes. Mm-hmm. Do you know if they're taxed as far as, like, Social Security, state, federal taxes? Or how are they paid? Do the farmers or the dairymen pay them, you know, so-called under the table, or are they giving them checks? I'm just wondering how that system works. But all the interaction I've had with them, I work in EMS, and the interaction has been these are dedicated, sincere people trying to support their families, but we just have the law systems, the way they're made up, it's very hard for them to come here legally or however you want to call that. And so I was just curious as to, are they paid, so they're paying taxes, or are they not?
Yeah. Larry, so it's a great question. I would say that the vast majority of farmers that I've interviewed feel that just the same way that you do, that these are hardworking, law-abiding folks who want to help themselves and help their families by doing good work here in Vermont. Most of them, mostly they are actually paid and they do pay taxes, and they won't get the benefit of those taxes.
And
right, that's what I've seen, and it's been, you know, the groups that I've run into They stay to themselves. I don't speak Spanish, but when I've had to interact with them, I've been able to help them out on some emergency situations. Mm-hmm. And again, they just feel like they're hardworking and they're doing jobs that it doesn't seem like we can find local people to do, because that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I think dairy farmers would agree with you. You know, a dairy farmer who could hire a local person who'd work just as hard as somebody from outside the country who speaks English, I think most dairy farmers would say that'd be great. They can't find them consistently across the state.
Exactly right. I run a business, and I'm having the same problem. But one thing that's my problem runs into, my biggest competitor for employees is the state of Vermont. And they have a thing called the benefit cliff, which the state legislature has put together so that people that are collecting unemployment and collecting on the state system are making the equivalent to $22 per hour. I've had them come in. I've talked to the state about this. I've talked to many others. So if I want to hire somebody that's on the state system of collecting, I've got to start them out at $22 an hour, which is totally insane.
Dan, you were telling me during the break about you were giving me a brief introduction to a program that is designed to enhance food sovereignty, I think you said, for the farm workers. What is that?
Well, I think I'll let Naomi talk about it, but Huertas is a program with Naomi and Teresa Mayers at UVM. Naomi, you probably want to talk about that.
Huertas, Naomi, let's hear about it.
So I believe you had Teresa on a bit ago, and she and I support or co-direct a food access project, which helps workers establish kitchen gardens and to grow what they want to grow. And so we really have a broad range of support with a lot of growers around the state who help donate different starts, who grow some specialty things like epazote and chipolin and different herbs that you wouldn't otherwise find in the state. Mm-hmm. And so we help about 30 households in northern Vermont grow what they want during the months of the year that they can actually grow stuff.
That's a cool thing. I mean, I'm just imagining now perhaps some of the farm workers putting on a meal and saying, hey, come, saying to the farm owners, come on by and share some of our food and learn something about, the cuisine of Chiapas or whatever.
Mm-hmm. We've definitely seen examples of that where there's an abundance of food that's being grown and the families and individuals are really open to sharing that, with their employers, particularly where there's a good relationship. So I'm sure there's a lot of farm owners that otherwise wouldn't know what tamales are.
Yeah, you know, that kind of cross-cultural thing actually can be a pretty amazing just human interaction. That stuff is, I think, a lot of fun and really makes life interesting beyond anything that might have been expected for folks for a long time, living on a dirt road in northern Vermont. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Hey, let's bring a caller in. Jen from Washington is on the line. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning. Since you guys were talking about health and farming, well, I guess I should mention that I am a dairy farmer. Mm-hmm. We have a small organic farm. We have robotic milkers because we've never been able to find quality help. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to respond to a common thought that I hear from people all the time is that small farms are the way to go, because what I see is a lot of high levels of stress on small farms. Mm-hmm. People have this idea that small farms, it's this romantic thought that it's a family farm and everyone gets along and everyone's great and happy. But a lot of the work always seems to fall on one or two people, and I see a lot of high levels of depression in the dairy community.
Yeah.
Versus when I go on a large farm, there is a crew of people. They're all sharing the workload, much healthier attitude. It really worries me how stressed out my fellow dairy farmers are.
Dan, what do you find? What are you hearing about that from when you go out and talk with farmers?
No, I think what you just said is a really important point. I think that what's going on our farms right now is, for our farmers, is a lot of stress. particularly for our dairy farmers, but I know for all farmers. It's interesting. We're just about to start a project kind of looking at whole farm health with Vermont Department of Health, Naomi's programs, other partners, because I agree with you. I think that it's not there's not just like one group that's stressed on our farms, and we really want to be thinking about how what we can do to provide either services or assistance or strategies to reduce stress overall.
The stress, obviously, that kind of stress, depression, et cetera, is a key part of the overall health of farm workers, too. I'm thinking also, Naomi, is that right?
Certainly. I think somebody's mental and emotional health really impacts their ability to live a good life, and particularly from an economic standpoint, be a productive worker. And so if you're within this climate of, you know, farm owners feeling stressed about the vitality of their farm and farm workers feeling stressed, it's definitely sometimes a crisis situation.
Yeah, that's just part of the tough life, and I appreciated what Jen said also just about. I think sometimes folks have this romantic notion of life on the farm, and of course that's what gets played up in various TV shows and so on and so forth from time to time, and it's not the reality. The reality is a lot more complicated and at times quite difficult, and from both perspectives, from the perspective of the workers and the farm owners, people do love it. They want to be on the farm, but it's not always easy. Hey, we are in the fast coming up to the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, and I really appreciated an opportunity to get this broader range of perspectives on life on the farm for farm workers in Vermont and farm owners. My guests have been Naomi Walcott-McCausland, farm migrant health coordinator, and with the Bridges to Health program and UVM Extension, and also Dan Baker has been doing a lot of survey work with the University of Vermont, the Vermont Survey of Farm Workers and Farm Owners, and appreciate your perspectives. Thanks very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
Alrighty, that's about it for the Dave Graham Show on this Thursday morning. I appreciate all the listeners out there checking us out, and do so again tomorrow, folks. We'll be back about 9:05 tomorrow morning. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. Have a great day, everybody.